books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today a roundup of some of the best non-fiction interviews we've had when I escaped from the studio and went to a book festival. Plus, we'll hear about some brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library, including a memoir by Sandy Toksvig. All that and more on today's Read On. All interviews today were recorded at the Boswell Book Festival, the world's only book festival about biography and memoir. Later on the show, we'll hear from Nigel Havers, from Frank Skinner, from Denise Mina, and from Giles and Mary from Gogglebox. But first up, let's hear from a book edited by Emma Soames called Mary Churchill's War.
Mary was just 16 years old when she resolved to keep a diary at the beginning of 1939. Her early entries capture the innocence of the last days of her childhood, spent in comparative isolation in the beautiful countryside around Chartwell, the family home in Kent. Her religious faith and her love of riding are evident, while episodes of teenage angst are interspersed with occasional forays into a more glamorous adult world. She is unquestioningly loyal to her papa, but initially at least, the political news and deteriorating international situation only occasionally intrude into her cosy domestic narrative.
Emma Soames is a legendary journalist, former editor of the Literary Review, Tatler, Saga, Evening Standard and Telegraph magazines, and she's also the granddaughter of Winston Churchill. In her book, Mary Churchill's War, she edits her mother's diaries, many of which have never been published, and provides a unique front row view of the great events of war, as well as exchanges and intimate moments with her father. They also show an impulsive and spirited writer, untrammelled by hindsight or self-censorship, or nostalgia. In 1939, 17-year-old Mary found herself in an extraordinary position at an extraordinary time. It was the outbreak of the Second World War, and her father, Winston Churchill, had been appointed First Lord of the Admiralty. Within months, he would be Prime Minister. The young Mary Churchill was uniquely placed to observe this remarkable historical moment, but also capture what it was like to be a young woman during wartime.
Mary accompanies her parents to France in August, though the worsening political situation means that her father both goes out first and comes back early. Suddenly, war seems so horribly near, so inevitable. On the 1st of September, Germany moves against Poland after having first secured a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. Prime Minister Chamberlain recalls Churchill to the War Cabinet as First Lord of the Admiralty. 2 days later, the British ultimatum to Berlin expires and war with Germany is declared.
They are the wartime diaries of my mother, who it was called Mary Soames, but before that, when she wrote them, she was Mary Churchill, and she was the youngest daughter of the war Prime Minister, Winston Churchill.
And how did the book come about?
Well, she left her diaries to Churchill College, Cambridge, to the Archive Centre, and after her death, I'm her literary executor, and we looked at the diaries and decided that although she had used some of the material out of the diaries in her memoir, A Daughter's Tale, there was lots of other rich things in the years she covered, and so we decided to publish.
Sunday, the 1st of January. Saw 1939 out and 1939 in with Punch at Breckles. Went for longish walk in AM with Nana. Walked again in PM. Great fun and most energetic. Read mainly after tea. My resolutions are 1. To say prayers much more carefully. 2. To be much more regular, read letters, accounts, etc., and especially my zoo is to be attended to. 3. To have greater strength of purpose. 4. To keep a diary. 5. To read lots of good books. I am really going to try to keep these. May God bless my year and be with all those I love.
Now, you're an editor yourself. How hard was it to decide what to leave in and what to cut out?
Well, really, there was certainly no sort of censorship. But for length, I did cut. Really, where it's a bit repetitious. I mean, you know, like all teenagers, she did go on a bit about her state of mind or her, you know, her appearance or something. So we kept a bit of that, but at the same time, we took out the repetitious bits.
And she said some of it may have been hot-making?
Yes. Her word for embarrassing was hot-making. And I think some of these diaries she would have regarded as hot-making because they were a teenager, an innocent teenager talking. But that is also part of their charm.
You read some of the audiobook. How was that?
Yes, I've read all the bits that aren't my mother talking, because obviously I do not sound like a 17-year-old girl. But I've read the introduction. I read the introduction of each year. At the beginning of each year, we've got a page or so explaining what was going on in the war and in the world at that point, which makes it then when you start reading the text of the diaries, you don't have to keep thinking what was going on then. I read all that, and then there's a very good actress who the publishers use a lot, and she reads She Is My Mother.
Friday, 6th of January. Read and finished Bleak House during day. I enjoyed it very much, but the ending was not altogether satisfactory, what with Richard dying and Caddy's baby being a deaf mute. And anyway, I don't believe I ever got over Esther being pockmarked. Road in PM. Fears re-hunting because of frost. After tea, rang up Sam Marsh, who runs the local riding school. No hunting. Boo-hoo. But 2 hours later, Sam Marsh rang me. Weather forecasts and thaw made prospect of hunting probable. Whoopee! Oh dear, God is so wonderful. I do appreciate everything he does.
I think she's done a very good job, and it you know, it bounces along at quite a good pace. It's not sort of, you know, you don't long to put 1.5, increase the speed. You don't feel like doing that.
Now, during your talk, and just to end this, you told about your big brother.
Yes. So when he was a very old man living at Chartwell, my elder brother Nicholas once bounced into his study and said, "Grandpapa, Grandpapa, is it true that you're England's greatest man?" And Grandpapa said, "Yes, now bugger off."
Saturday, 18th of March. The German invasion of Czechoslovakia crisis seems to be becoming more serious. Papa said, "Before God Almighty, I swear I do not wish for war." I write this as a witness.
From air raid sirens at 10 Downing Street to seeing action with the ETS. From cocktail parties with presidents and royals to accompanying her father on key diplomatic trips. Mary's wartime diaries are full of colour, rich in historical insight and a charming and intimate portrait of life alongside Winston Churchill. They're narrated by Beth Eyre and Emma Soames and available commercially now.
We'll have more festival interviews later on in the show, but now a trip to the RNIB Talking Books Library with Lynn Livingston.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. First this week, we have Between the Stops by Sandy Toksvig, which was donated by Little Brown.
I had a fifth grade teacher called Mrs. Strange. It was 1968. I was 10 and living in the small town of Mamaroneck, New York, a seaside suburb on Long Island Sound. Mrs. Strange was from Arkansas. Her accent was slow and southern, and she drawled her way laboriously through all information, like sieving it through a mint julep. It never occurred to me to wonder if Strange was her real name or merely a general description. Her hair was pulled so tightly into a bun that it gave her a permanently startled look, as if she'd arrived through a wind tunnel. She looked like Miss Gulch in The Wizard of Oz. She once gave me detention for declaring I had seen snow at the equator. "Not possible," she drawled. "The equator is hot." I had seen snow on top of Mount Kilimanjaro when I was about 4, but she said it with such firmness that it had to be so. To this day, there must be adults who passed through her care who do not believe there could be snow in Africa. It was an early lesson in my understanding that grown-ups can be wrong. I am a grown-up and have been wrong so many times. Dear God, how it distresses me that on my 21st birthday, the 3rd of May, 1979, Margaret Thatcher came to power and I was naive enough to think it would be a good thing for a woman to be in charge.
This long-awaited memoir from one of Britain's best-loved celebrities, a writer, broadcast, activist, comic on stage, screen and radio for nearly 40 years, presenter of QI and Great British Bake Off star, is an autobiography with a difference, as only Sandy Toksvig can tell it. From London facts, including where to find the blue plaque for Una Mason, the first black woman programme maker at the BBC, to discovering the best Spanish coffee under Southwark's railway arches, from a brief history of lady gangsters at Elephant and Castle, to memories of climbing Mount Sinai, and, at the request of a fellow traveller, reading aloud the Ten Commandments. From the story behind Pizarro's painting of Dulwich Station, to performing in Footlights with Emma Thompson. From painful memories of being sent to Coventry while at a British boarding school, to thinking about how Womble's travelling circus of 1864 haunts Peckham Rye. From anecdotes about meeting Prince Charles, Monica Lewinsky and Grayson Perry, to Bake Off antics, from stories of a real and lasting friendship with John McCarthy, to the importance of family and the daunting navigation of the Zambezi River in her father's canoe, this Sandy Toksvig-style memoir is, as one would expect and hope, packed full of surprises. A funny and moving trip through memories, musings and the many delights on the No. 12 route, between the stops, is also an inspiration to us all to get off our phones, look up and talk to each other because, as Sandy says, some of the greatest trips lie on our own doorstep.
It was Mrs. Strange who taught me to do joined-up writing. I don't suppose in the current era of the keyboard being king that these things matter anymore, but she was adamant that I learn to make my letters flow. Indeed, we spent many hours learning to flow. Mrs. Strange insisted that the entire class slant their lined paper to the left at a 45-degree angle so that our script lurched away from the centre as if keen to escape. They say your handwriting says a lot about you. I think mine says a lot about Mrs. Strange. On reflection, she probably had a leaning to the right about most things. Mrs. Strange is in my mind because recently I had to fill in a form by hand. I realised how little I use a pen to write anything anymore. The biro felt unfamiliar and my writing sloped away as if out of control. We moved house to a suburb of London called East Dulwich, and I decided to join the local library. It's often my first thought when I'm anywhere new and unfamiliar. I think if I have access to books, I shall make sense of it all. I'm sure everyone else does just as well having coffee somewhere and trying to make friends. The trouble is, I don't have any small talk, so I do libraries, where no one talks at all. I thought this one looked nice. Well, nice enough. Built from a Victorian kit. I suspect there was a kit for libraries, one for schools and another for public baths. The white-haired librarian gave me a form to fill in. When I handed it back, she looked at my details, then looked again at me, and then back at the form. "You're not her," she said matter-of-factly. "You're not Sandy Toksvig." I paused, wondering, not for the first time, who I am. "What makes you say that?" I asked. She looked at me accusingly. "You're too quiet." "It's a library," I replied, lowering my voice still further. "I've done libraries before."
Between the Stops, the view of my life from the top of the No. 12 bus, is written and read by Sandy Toksvig and runs for 9 hours, 31 minutes.
Next we have The Wildflowers by Harriet Evans, which was given to us by Headline.
The abandoned house, covered in bindweed and brambles, didn't look like anything much when first glimpsed from the lane. But after the two men had struggled through the tangled mass of wild flowers and creepers surrounding the house, they came upon a porch. The steps up were blackened with rot. On the porch itself rested a long abandoned cane chair, bleached silver grey by the wind and the sea, and chained to the decaying floorboards by the tendrils of a pink and sage Virginia creeper. Below came the shingling slap of gentle waves, and when you turned towards the sound of the sea, there was Worth Bay curving away from you, cream-yellow sands, turquoise water, chalk-white rocks in the distance. Dave Nichols, trainee agent at Mayhew & Fine, watched in irritation as Frank Mayhew paused on the sandy path, fiddling in his pocket for the key. It was a boiling hot day, the sun beating down remorselessly.
Tony and Althea Wilde, glamorous, argumentative, adulterous to the core. They were my parents, actors known by everyone. They gave our lives love and colour in a house by the sea, the house that sheltered my orphaned father when he was a boy. But the summer Mads arrived, changed everything. She too had been abandoned, and my father understood why. We wildflowers took her in. My father was my hero. He gave us a golden childhood, but the past was always going to catch up with him. It comes for us all sooner or later. This is my story. I am Cordelia Wilde, a singer without a voice, a daughter without a father. Let me take you inside.
A mother and a young girl in swimming costumes, carrying towels, passed by on their way to the beach, looking at them with curiosity. Dave felt stupid, standing there in his smarter suit in front of this rotten old building. "I don't understand," he said sulkily. "Why we have to value it when the old girl's not going to sell?" Frank tutted in disapproval. "Old girl? That's Lady Wilde to you, Dave, and she's not long for this world. Have some respect. Listen, in a few months, when she's gone, the family'll most likely want to sell. They don't care about the place, that's obvious. That's where we come in, see?" He turned to take in the glorious view of the bay, then glanced at his slouched, sullen trainee, the son of an old golfing buddy, and sighed very gently. "If we play our cards right, we'll be the agents to handle the sale. Houses on Worth Bay don't come up often. There's only 10 or so of them. The Bosky, it's prime beachfront property, this place."
The Wildflowers by Harriet Evans is read by Lucy Patterson and runs for 16 hours, 43 minutes. And we'll have two more books from Lynn later on in the show.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m, enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
I've covered the Boswell Book Festival for many years, and in 2022, in attendance were Frank Skinner and Denise Mina, there to talk about their TV shows, Wordsworth and Coleridge's Romantic Road Trip, and of course, Boswell and Johnson's Scottish Road Trip.
In 1773, the famous English writer Samuel Johnson made a grand tour of Scotland. He was accompanied by his friend, the Edinburgh-born James Boswell, and both wrote accounts of their travels. I'm going to follow in their footsteps.
Hello, Frank, how are you?
Like Boswell.
And like Johnson, my travelling companion is a best-selling Scottish writer, Denise Minor.
I'll talk to them both about the TV show in a moment, but first I asked Frank Skinner how he was enjoying Ayrshire.
I really like being in Auchinleck. I walked from my hotel room to the place where we have dinner on the first night I arrived. And I think it was the first time I realised how filthy the air is in London. Because I thought, what is that? What is that stuff in my lungs that I don't recognise? Oh, it's air. So the air is beautiful. And then today, and I honestly, in my hand, your listeners will have to trust me on this, I'm holding the programme for the Robert Burns Birthplace Museum. And I went absolutely through the Burns ceiling this morning. So I went to the Birthplace Museum. I stood on Brigadoon, and I was on Brigadoon, and a man stopped me and played me two tracks from his album. He was a singer-songwriter who was passing by. So I wasn't expecting that. But the whole Burns thing, the cottage and that, it was brilliant. I'm so fired up now to get home and read Burns for 2 weeks.
So I'm sitting with a copy of Frank Skinner by Frank Skinner. How long ago did you write this?
That was published in 2000. In fact, it was the second highest-selling autobiography in 2000. Second only to A Child Called It. I don't know if you remember that. Mine had got more jokes.
So you're both here because of your Sky Arts show. Tell us about that.
Frank picks the subject usually because Frank's very broadly read. So it's usually two people who've been on a journey together. We take a character each, and then we basically get to go on a jolly for 3 weeks.
Yeah, and absolutely wallow in that particular writer, which is fab. Because often when you're sort of reading, I don't know, William Wordsworth, for example, it's you think, I should be doing some work now. So if you can actually move things around so it is work, then that is when life is happy.
You know what Mark Twain said? Make your vocation your vacation. And that's
very
what we've done.
Good. And do you know what Noel Coward said? Work is much more fun than fun.
Did he?
Yeah, he did. Oh, I love that. And it is in this line of work.
Yeah, so we're very lucky. We keep getting to do it over and over again.
And, of course, the first one was, well, at the Boswell Book Festival, was Boswell's Journey.
Yeah, so I was mad about Samuel Johnson. And so I wanted to do this thing. But I said, I'm going to need a Scottish person, a Boswell person. And I think it should be a woman because, you know, I don't want it to be another, like, two white guys talking about two white guys. So I was sent a bunch of people, and I got to...
We did an audition. He was sent videos of
people. Yeah, videos. I meant they didn't arrive in a chain gang. And I meant videos. And there was one of you being interviewed by Craig Ferguson, one of Denise being interviewed by Craig Ferguson. I honestly got about 3 minutes in and thought, that's the one. So... So that was fab, and it's been brilliant. I don't want to speak for Denise, but I think we like exploring each other's heads a bit, and there's a lot of that when we just get a chance to absolutely chew over various literary, historical, political issues, and it's bliss.
It is, honestly. It's absolutely, I mean, I think we met at Dr. Johnson's house and it was kind of like, are you going to get on? And after about 3 minutes, Frank said to the producer, Franny, I think you can leave us alone. I think we're going to be on.
Yeah, I think they were getting, in case they needed to separate us physically.
This is a fight.
What was it like getting the phone call saying you'd got the job?
Well, I didn't know I was up for the job. They just said, would you like to do this? And I said, oh, Frank Skinner's brilliant. Everybody says that. But No, they do, actually.
Okay.
They do.
Okay.
They
I raise my eyebrows.
They don't know you, Frank. They don't know you at all. And I thought, oh, that'd be great. But, I mean, you know, one of the things about being a writer is you're always looking for adventures to get involved in. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So even if it's a bad adventure, if you end up stuck at a book festival in the middle of Spain and there's nothing but blood sausage and bagpipes, which has actually happened to me, it's still an adventure. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
But so sometimes they are quite arduous, but this one has been a total joy. We just get to be really nerdy, and the access we get, that's the thing that always gets me, is we get access to, I think if you say to people, we have a TV company, can we come and
They'll say, come and hold William Wordsworth's wedding ring or something like that, and you actually get to do that. Yeah. That access
thing. You can tell from how hushed we sound, how thrilled we are by that stuff.
Yeah. But I went to see, Denise gave a talk today because she wrote a book about Mary, Queen of Scots, and I went to the talk at the Boswell Book Festival, which was brilliant. But she was talking in that about getting a private tour of Holyrood Castle and all that. And I thought, yeah, that is the best thing about this job is I've spent years looking over people's shoulders at art exhibitions trying to see the picture. And suddenly someone says, oh, yeah, you can come and see it, but come at 6 o'clock at night when it's shot. And that, oh, man, that. I used to dream about getting into the toy shop down the road after it was shot. And it's like that.
There are many books by Denise Mina in the RNIB Talking Books Library and available commercially. Frank Skinner's book, Frank Skinner on the Road, is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Adrian Grove. Frank Skinner by Frank Skinner and Frank Skinner, A Comedian's Prayer Book are both available in audio commercially now. Thanks once again to Frank Skinner and Denise Mina. And staying in the world of TV, at the Boswell Book Festival, I spoke to Giles Wood and Mary Killen, possibly best known as Giles and Mary from Gogglebox. Before I asked them about the books they were at the festival with, which were Country Life, A Story of Peaks and Troughs, and The Diary of Two Nobodies, and before I asked them for the books of their life, I had to ask them about Gogglebox. They were recommended to the producers by a friend of a friend, and apparently the producers only want people to appear who don't want to appear.
It sounded as though something we should have been fending off, but then I think we thought, well, let's give it a try. There's no harm in giving it a try. So we had a pilot program made, and very unusually, the pilot program featured an item that actually got into the show. So then they took us on full-time rather than just on approval, as it were.
And you didn't want to be on at all?
No, I didn't want to be on. And I didn't want my privacy invaded, but we came to a compromise, which was that I wouldn't go on social media. And then I couldn't see the rude things trolls would say about us, because that would have been upsetting. But I'm blissfully unaware of what anyone thinks of us now.
But anyway, and as someone else said, we live on another planet anyway, so it wouldn't have made any difference. But I actually quite like reading the... me and Robbie Williams, we like reading Twitter, especially at 3 a.m. Fascinating world, but a disreputable world, I think. What's his name has taken it over now? Elon Musk.
Yeah, yeah.
What's it for, Twitter, Mary?
Oh, it's just for people to air their views on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about the book you're here with today.
Well, it's the second of our two books, and it'll be the last of them.
Why?
Well, I don't think we've got another book in us. This is our swan song, as someone said.
Your swan song?
Yes, because with the deterioration of the brain cells, I didn't think I could make the huge effort required to write a magnum opus like this.
But you did manage to rise to the occasion.
I did rise to the occasion, and it seems to be going well, and it was illustrated by me, and that was one of the nicer bits of this book, is that it's got illustrations in it. So you probably haven't seen books with illustrations since children's books.
Yeah.
And some of the illustrations are a bit childish, aren't they, Mary?
No,
especially
beautiful.
The one you did of me. Oh, you should have shown that picture to the audience, the one
yes,
you did
the
of
one
me.
I did of you.
She's
yeah,
done a very rude caricature of me on page one. Yeah.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the audiobook from RNIB is the cover. Can you describe the cover for us?
The cover is a mishmash of scenes from our village, where we go into the churchyard of our village, and then instead of the big house, they've superimposed our thatched cottage into the background.
So, and the downland is rolling behind it.
So it's a composite, the picture. And the lettering is very strange on the book, isn't it, Mary?
I think it
looks like Janet and John. The person that put up my greenhouse commented on the appearance of the book, and he said, why has it got white letters against the sky? Wouldn't it have been better to put black letters against the sky? And things. Anyway, these creative decisions, often you don't really notice right until the last minute. But I suddenly got interested in the appearance of letters, because we got to know a man who was a typographer. Is that the name of him? So you suddenly start noticing different types of lettering, and actually they're quite sort of important in conveying what message you're getting across. Hmm. And I'm not sure what the message is with our book, Mary.
Basically it's meant to cheer people up, because people seem to think we're funny for some reason.
Yes,
it's so odd for us, isn't it?
It's got a little bit of... it's tragicomic, would you describe, Mary?
Yes, probably.
And in the middle of it, it's got quite a good bit. It's like the meat in a sandwich, where we've got some local codgers who describe all the changes that have happened in the village, in the Wiltshire village, in the last 50 years. And a lot of them, one of them blames the train station for bringing in a whole lot of outsiders, including us. Yeah. Although we didn't arrive by train, we arrived by car.
No, but it was a little backwater, and then a functioning train station, fast train to London, came in, and that has changed the atmosphere.
In our last book, The Diary of Two Nobodies, Giles and I charted a year in the lives of two technically incompatible people living together in a country cottage. One socially ambitious, the other a recluse, happiest when staring into a ditch and going slowly downhill, as one old friend observed. Correction, we're not completely incompatible. We share a sense of humour and a taste in friends. But in this book, we turn the lens away from ourselves to examine the world outside the cottage window. 30 years ago, when we moved to Wiltshire, the decision made financial sense. For the same price as a basement in the outskirts of London, we could have a full cottage with 1 acre of garden in a beauty spot with real villagers around us, i.e. not weekenders. I would be cheated of the social possibilities of the city, but Giles and our then baby would be far happier. Others were following suit. It made sense to them too, especially to those who could exchange a 3-bed flat in Islington for an old rectory in the country. The trickle became a flood during the pandemic. In the absence of FOMO, no one anywhere was doing anything social or cultural. Why not do nothing in the country? Country living, it suddenly became clear, offered a better quality of life, beauty, space, community and health.
For 30 years, the 3 streetlights in our village have tormented me. But, say some, surely you don't object to the new energy-efficient dimmer LED versions? Well, yes, I do, actually. According to my British Wildlife magazine, the former orange sodium lights were, paradoxically, less damaging to biodiversity and moths than the new LED ones. Either way, on return to our grottage, I was forced to walk some distance in the freezing cold to find a spot away from light pollution where I might try to take a second look at the mysterious fuzzy blob then approaching the constellation Camelopardalis. In some ways, as a malcontent, the Neanderthal age might have suited me, because life would involve only binary choices, such as eat or die, except that I am not a team player, which would have meant an even shorter life expectancy. But on the plus side, plenty of bioabundance, and at least I could have got through life without medication for high blood pressure caused, in part, by street lighting. Modern life has gotten too darn complicated, and country life is no exception to this rule.
Now, you narrated the audio version of the book. How was that?
Well, it was nice, actually. We went to Chippenham, where there was a studio with soundproof booths, and a Zoom person directed us from Cumbria. And so that was a bit odd. But she said that before COVID, she used to come to London every week, but now they've realised she can do it just as well by Zoom. And we enjoyed talking to her, but it's like one of all of these office life things that have changed. It's more fun to be in an office with people in real life, isn't it? I mean, you can do the things by Zoom, but I think human interaction is very... there's something extra about it. But anyway, we read through it and she stopped us every so often and told us to go again, or we'd been breathing too heavily or something. But we did it in 2 days, didn't we?
We did it in record time. The funny thing is that when you're reading something out, you get better and better at it as you do it. It's like anything. It's like riding a bicycle or skating. So when we first started it, we sounded a bit adenoidal, as if we'd just got out of bed. And then as the day wore on, all our passages started to clear. And we were starting to quite enjoy reading out what we'd written. And I hope that comes across in the audible version.
Yeah.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood. The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Wednesdays at 8 p.m., Thursday at noon, and Sundays at 11 a.m.
The Moth on RNIB Connect Radio.
At the end of the show, we'll hear from Nigel Havers and his book Playing with Fire. But now, let's return to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
This best-selling thriller has been long awaited. It's The Year of the Locust by Terry Hayes and was donated by Penguin Random House.
I once went to kill a man. At other times, in younger days, I had followed my work through the neon-lit alleys of Tokyo, watched the sun rise over the Mosque of the Nine Cupolas, and waited on the waterfront in old Istanbul as a woman's tears fell like rain. This time, it was way out east, where the Aegean Sea runs into the Mediterranean and the Turkish sun beats down on a chain of tiny islands. The smallest of them was also the most remote. Waves broke over the wreck of a freighter lying on a reef, dangerous currents swirled through hidden coves, and a fishing village, its wooden boats long gone, was nothing but ruins now. I landed in late spring, put ashore by the Egyptian skipper of a tramp steamer, who was wise enough not to ask many questions. I can still recall the breeze on my face and the heady scent of pine needles as I moved through a silent forest. As I have done for most of my working life, I stuck close to the shadows. My target that day was a brave man, no doubt of it, supposedly a German out of Nuremberg. That beautiful old city, steeped in so much dark history. And when I surprised him in the kitchen of his lonely villa, we both knew I had traveled a long distance, both in miles and in years, to arrive at such a deadly rendezvous.
If, like Kane, you're a denied access area spy for the CIA, then boundaries have no meaning. Your function is to go in, do whatever is required, and get out again by whatever means necessary. You know when to run, when to hide, and when to shoot. But some places don't play by the rules. Some places are too dangerous, even for a man of Kane's experience. The Badlands, where the borders of Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan meet, are such a place where violence is the only way to survive. Kane travels there to exfiltrate a man with vital information for the safety of the West, but instead he meets an adversary who will take the world to the brink of extinction, a frightening, clever, vicious man with blood in his hands and vengeance in his heart.
I was a member of the agency back then, and for many years had gone under the code name Kane. 5 years earlier, the German had been a trusted asset of U.S. intelligence in Tehran. What nobody knew, but found out soon enough, was that he was secretly working as a contractor for the Russians. It seems like everything is being outsourced these days, even espionage. On a quiet Monday night, he had gone for a late meal in the bistro at Tehran's Gilded Espinas Palace Hotel, and in the men's room had delivered the names of 10 of our most valuable Iranian sources to a representative of Moscow Central. It is well known in the secret world that the spy agencies of Russia and Iran have worked hand in glove for years, so it was inevitable that the list of names would end up with Pava, the brutal Iranian secret police. As a result, our network, built over many years at a huge cost in lives and treasure, and more importantly, a vital backdoor into the Iranian nuclear program, was destroyed within hours. Even for the CIA, an organization that had known its fair share of failure, it ranked as an unqualified disaster. The consequences for the 8 men and 2 women who were unmasked as a result of our assets' betrayal were far more catastrophic. They appeared before a judge in a late-night trial, and the next day workmen started to assemble 10 towering construction cranes in one of Tehran's largest squares. While members of the public didn't pay much attention at first, their purpose soon became clear. It was to ensure that as many people as possible could witness the court's sentence being carried out. In many countries in the Middle East, it is not enough that people are punished. Everybody else must be warned.
The Year of the Locust by Terry Hayes is narrated by Jeff Harding and runs for 22 hours, 25 minutes.
For those who have been following the Falconer series by Barbara Taylor Bradford, we have the latest in the series from HarperCollins. It's called The Wonder of It All.
James Falconer was in the 4th Army and proud of it. Tonight, the 30th of June 1916, he was sitting in a corner of his trench, thinking. His seat was a crate full of Fray Bentos tins of corned beef, and he smiled to himself at the very idea of this. But you made the best of it in the trenches, he knew that. He glanced up at the sky. It was ink black, littered with stars, and there was a full moon. A beautiful night in an awful world, and eerily quiet. No sounds of bombs exploding or guns being fired. Odd, he now thought, and stood up. At this moment, two of his officers, Lieutenant Stead and Captain Lister, came back down the ladder and walked along their trench towards him. "What's it like out there?" Major James Falconer asked, as the two men came to a standstill in front of him and saluted. "All quiet on the Western Front, sir," Stead said. "Quiet as a mouse," Lister added. "Some mice, indeed," James shot back. "I get suspicious when there are no sounds, no noises. Anyway, did you get it done?" "We did," Stead answered. "Perfectly." "How did you manage that?" James asked, looking pleased. "Very carefully," Lister grinned. "We cut the barbed wire fence attached to the iron stakes at one end using our best wire cutters. Then we took a piece of chain and slotted it through parts of the freed barbed wire. Together we then pulled the chain until we'd made a big enough gap to let 10 soldiers through at once. Best we could do, Major."
The Somme, 1916. James Falconer, once a barrow boy in a London market, stands in the trenches, awaiting the command to go over the top. Away from his business empire in London, he is simply a soldier, war, the great leveller. But unlike his men, and unknown to them deep down, Falconer doesn't care if he lives or dies. When a face from the past offers James the chance to repair his fractured relationship with his estranged daughter Leonie, he must decide if he can hold different things dear and make space in his life for love. But the war has left terrible scars, both personal and professional, and swept huge changes through the glittering world he once inhabited. James must weather myriad storms as he attempts to right past wrongs and build a new life.
You did well. Now we're all set for tomorrow morning. 0 hour, Lister murmured, and added, I'll be back in a minute. He hurried off and turned left, going down another trench amongst this maze of connecting trenches. These housed more soldiers, were used as kitchens, latrines, and for checking any minor wounds and blisters on the feet. Marching in heavy boots caused problems for Falconer's lads. He sighed under his breath at the thought of the weight his soldiers had to carry when they went out to fight the enemy. Not only a large bag over one shoulder, but a water bottle, a Lee Enfield rifle, a haversack, plus ammunition. About 60 pounds altogether. No easy feat, but they did it well and with stoicism, and fought with precision. Stead, leaning against the side of the trench, cleared his throat and said, I'll be glad when tomorrow comes and we start fighting. Get it over with, sir. James nodded. Not so sure it will be over quite so quickly, Lieutenant.
The Wonder of It All by Barbara Taylor Bradford is narrated by Joan Walker and runs for 9 hours 45 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, let's have a run.
You're listening to Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival. Now, the Curtain Up event at this year's festival featured an evening with Nigel Havers, who was there to talk about his autobiography, Playing With Fire. The unabridged RNIB talking book version is read by Charles Armstrong.
By the time we came to shoot what would be the opening scene in Chariots of Fire, I had been inhabiting the skin of Lord Alfred Lindsay for several months. So, when Hugh Hudson, the director, asked if I felt able to age up in order to play my character as a man well into his 80s, I had little hesitation. The scene was a memorial service for the sprinter Harold Abrahams and took place in a London church. I had to spend 6 hours in makeup. As the face in the mirror got steadily older, I started remembering my grandfather, the way he walked, the way he talked and held his head. And as the finishing touches were at last applied, I suddenly remembered that Dad's chambers were just round the corner, so rang and invited him to come to the set and watch some of the morning's filming. When he arrived, he walked straight past me and professed not to recognise me at all until he heard my voice. I'm not sure if his reaction was genuine, or whether he was doing it to give me pleasure. Either way, it was rather charming. My father was quite a guy. He had two passions, the law and living, the first providing the second. Law runs through the Havers family like blood runs through veins. My grandfather was Sir Cecil Havers, a notable High Court judge who was famous for, among other things, sentencing Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be executed in this country. My aunt is Dame Elizabeth Butler Sloss, also a High Court judge, and until recently head of the family justice system. My brother Philip is an eminent human rights barrister, and my niece Holly has recently joined one of London's largest firms of solicitors. Then there's me. Actually, I think every successful barrister has to have something of the actor in him. And Dad didn't just have a little something, he had it in spades. In 1981, as Attorney General, he was obliged to be Chief Prosecutor in the trial of Peter Sutcliffe, the notorious Yorkshire Ripper. On the day Dad started his case for the prosecution, I slipped into the viewing gallery. He had rung the week before to ask whether I wanted to come and see something special. "Is that the new play at the National?" I asked. "No," he replied.
I thought you might like to come and see me for a change. Peter Sutcliffe was surprisingly small, with wild black curly hair and very black eyes. The sort of eyes that have swallowed up the horror they have witnessed, and sacrificed all life and expression in the process, leaving dark holes the colour of deadly nightshade in their place. When the judge gestured for proceedings to begin, my father got slowly to his feet. He stood, motionless, looking down at his notes. Silence. He stayed like that for several minutes, the tension building to breaking point. Just as the judge was about to intervene, he looked up, straight into Sutcliffe's eyes. Another silence. "Could you confirm how you spell your name?" he said. "One T and two Fs. Is that right?" Sutcliffe just nodded. Dad turned. There was a flurry of activity from the junior counsel huddled behind him. Everyone in the courtroom seemed to be holding their breath. Another long silence. I think the judge thought Dad had lost the plot. Eventually, Dad turned and fixed Sutcliffe with a hawk-like stare. "At least we've got that right," he said. "Tell me, did you enjoy killing those women?" The air suddenly seemed to have been sucked out of the room. It became difficult to breathe, and people started to lick their lips. I looked down and saw goosebumps on my arms. It felt as if the air conditioning had suddenly been cranked up to maximum.
So begins Playing with Fire by Nigel Havers. At the Boswell Book Festival, he told me about the book.
Well, the book is about me. you know, it took me... I spent 3 months writing this book. 9 to 5, like I was sort of going to an office, I did it. And I was sort of rather dreading doing it to begin with, but I really enjoyed doing it in the end. And I didn't have too much interference, and... There you are. It was a fun experience.
And you read the abridged version?
I loved that. I've done sort of radio and commercial voiceovers for years. So I love just talking into a microphone. I find that kind of rather restful.
Life was hell. The lack of food and sleep were beginning to turn me stark, staring bonkers. Added to which, looking back, I think I truly began to believe that I was William Wills. For the one and only time in my life, a part began to inhabit my being, and I started behaving very oddly. One day, as I was putting on my filthy old costume and having the makeup done, I noticed that the shot required us to be practically crawling on the ground. It was to be filmed by a sodding great long lens, and Graham and the crew were sitting miles away, waiting for us to get into position. "I'm not going anywhere until that director comes over to say good morning," I said. Shock registered on the face of the third assistant. This normally mild-mannered and quite cheerful actor throwing a hissy fit, or spitting the dummy, as they call it over there. He quickly walked over to Graham. "Nigel says he's not doing anything until you come and say good morning." Pause. "Has he lost his mind?" "Well, I think he means it." I screwed up my eyes and watched Graham, dressed in his habitual white linen, walk the 100 yards or so to where I was standing. "Good morning," he said. And he turned on his heel and walked back. The outback can do strange things to a person. One scene took place in a dust storm, and we had to have aeroplane propellers chucking dust in our faces for 3 whole days, unimaginably foul for us. Piece of cake for Simon and the rest of the camels. Those guys can survive anything. We also had to contend with the flies. I know everyone talks about those Aussie flies, but until you experience them at first hand, you can have no idea how hellish they make your life. I wore a hat with a net whenever I wasn't actually on camera, but on one close-up a fly actually walked across my eye, right across the middle. I'm quite proud of the fact that I didn't flinch, but the secret fact is that because I wear contact lenses, I was just about able to bear it. Another time we were filming on some salt flats. You could see at least 100 miles in every direction, everything dancing in that torrid heat. The crew were about 0.5 mile away, filming with the longest lens in existence. There is only one of those lenses in the entire world because it is so expensive to produce. Directors have to put themselves on a list and queue to use it, all of which adds to the pressures of filming, as there is absolutely no margin for error. Jack and I were acting up a storm, half crazed with thirst and exhaustion. One of us glanced over at the crew and found that they had broken for lunch and forgotten to send the runner to tell us. "I'll kill them," I yelled. Jack was able to find this quite amusing,
but madman that I had become, I sulked for days.
Now, one chapter of the book stands out, your filming experience in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because the character I played in that movie, Birkenwood, was such an extreme, you know, to die in the middle of nowhere, and it got under my skin a bit. But it was a good experience and an amazing story.
Especially when you got back to civilization and you couldn't leave the hotel room.
I couldn't, know. I hadn't, see, we lived, you know, 800 miles from the nearest telephone or town. And after two months or so, you forget about things like traffic and noise and stuff. So when I came back to the big city, I got sort of agoraphobia. I couldn't leave. I couldn't leave the room. I couldn't cross the road. I tried to once, I just went straight back.
We eventually arrived in Adelaide, where we had a few days off before some more shooting just outside the city. It was terrifying. Suddenly, I found myself on my own in the middle of an enormous city, and I couldn't deal with the culture shock. By the time I got to my hotel room, I was a bundle of nerves, and I didn't leave the room for 2 days. I rang home to speak to Caro and give my love to Kate before I passed out. I just slept, ate room service food, and generally got my head together. The rest of the cast were doing exactly the same thing. We were all completely drained and exhausted.
Is it important that there's an accessible version of your book?
I actually have a sight problem myself, in fact. The retinal membrane at the back of my right eye is becoming unattached, so I have problems with my right eye, so I can, you know, understand how difficult it is to be blind, and I'm very aware of, you know, doing as much as I can to help.
Is that something that you're aware of on stage, like you have to be extra careful where your mark is and things like that?
I do now, yeah. I have to work much harder. It's putting a key into a keyhole is more difficult.
I realised I was grinning like an idiot. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew things were never going to be easy, but there was just a chance that, together, we could get life back on track. With post-production schedules in Sydney, we weren't due back in London for a couple of months. Whatever the future held, I'd be able to take a break from playing with fire.
Nigel Havers, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, there are over 350 episodes in our podcast feed. Just type Read On, RNIB, into your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.